This morrow at last came. That is to say, a day finally dawned upon a long and weary night of impatience, and then the hours until one were snail-paced, dreary and innumerable. But even Stamboul, it is said, shall have an end, and there came an end to this long delay. The clock struck. As the last echo ceased, I stepped into B's and inquired for Talbot.
"Out," said the footman.
Talbot's own.
"Out,"
I replied, staggering back half a dozen paces. "Let me tell you, my fine fellow, that this thing is thoroughly impossible and impracticable. Mr. Talbot is not out.
What do you mean?"
"Nothing, sir. Only Mr. Talbot is not in, that's all. He rode over to S immediately after breakfast and left word that he would not be in town again for a week."
I stood petrified with horror and rage. I endeavored to reply, but my tongue refused its office. At length, I turned on my heel, livid with wrath, and inwardly consigning the whole tribe of the Talbots to the innermost regions of Erebus. It was evident that my considerate friend, Il Fanatico, had quite forgotten his appointment with myself, had forgotten it as soon as it was made. At no time was he a very scrupulous man of his word. There was no help for it, so smothering my vexation as well as I could, I strolled moodily up the street, propounding futile inquiries about Madame Lalande to every male acquaintance I met. By report she was known, I found, to all, to many by sight, but she had been in town only a few weeks, and there were very few, therefore, who claimed her personal acquaintance. These few, being still comparatively strangers, could not or would not take the liberty of introducing me through the formality of a morning call. While I stood thus in despair, conversing with the trio of friends upon the all-absorbing subject of my heart, it so happened that the subject itself passed by.
"As I live, there she is!" cried one.
"Surprisingly beautiful!" exclaimed a second.
"An angel upon earth!"
ejaculated a third. I looked, and in an open carriage which approached us, passing slowly down the street, sat the enchanting vision of the opera, accompanied by the younger lady who had occupied a portion of her box.
"Her companion also wears remarkably well," said one of my trio who had spoken first.
"Astonishingly," said the second. "Still quite a brilliant air, but art will do wonders. Upon my word, she looks better than she did at Paris 5 years ago. A beautiful woman still. Don't you think so, Froissart? Simpson, I mean."
"Still," said I, "and why shouldn't she be?
But compared with her friend, she is as a rush light to the evening star, a glow-worm to Antares."
"Ha, ha, ha! Why, Simpson, you have an astonishing tact in making discoveries. Original ones, I mean."
And here we separated, while one of the trio began humming a gay vaudeville, of which I caught only the lines,
"Ninon, ninon, ninon, abat. Abat Ninon de l'Enclos."
During this little scene, however, one thing had served greatly to console me, although it fed the passion by which I was consumed. As the carriage of Madame Lalande rolled by our group, I had observed that she recognized me. And more than this, she had blessed me, by the most seraphic of all imaginable smiles, with no equivocal mark of the recognition. As for an introduction, I was obliged to abandon all hope of it until such time as Talbot should think proper to return from the country. In the meantime, I perseveringly frequented every reputable place of public amusement, and at length, at the theater where I first saw her, I had the supreme bliss of meeting her and of exchanging glances with her once again. This did not occur, however, until the lapse of a fortnight. Every day in the interim, I had inquired for Talbot at his hotel, and every day had been thrown into a spasm of wrath by the everlasting "not come home yet" of his footman. Upon the evening in question, therefore, I was in a condition little short of madness. Madame Lalande, I had been told, was a Parisian, had lately arrived from Paris. Might she not suddenly return? Return before Talbot came back? And might she not be thus lost to me forever? The thought was too terrible to bear. Since my future happiness was at issue,
I resolved to act with a manly decision. In a word, upon the breaking up of the play, I traced the lady to her residence, noted the address, and the next morning sent her a full and elaborate letter in which I poured out my whole heart. I spoke boldly, freely. In a word, I spoke with passion. I concealed nothing, nothing even of my weakness. I alluded to the romantic circumstances of our first meeting, even to the glances which had passed between us. I went so far as to say that I felt assured of her love. While I offered this assurance and my own intensity of devotion as two excuses for my otherwise unpardonable conduct, as a third, I spoke of my fear that she might quit the city before I could have the opportunity of a formal introduction. I concluded the most wildly enthusiastic epistle ever penned with a frank declaration of my worldly circumstances, of my affluence, and with an offer of my heart and of my hand. In an agony of expectation, I awaited the reply. After what seemed the lapse of a century, it came. Yes, actually came. Romantic as all this may appear, I really received a letter from Madame Lalande, the beautiful, the wealthy, the idolized Madame Lalande. Her eyes, her magnificent eyes, had not belied her noble heart. Like a true Frenchwoman, as she was, she had obeyed the frank dictates of her reason, the general impulses of her nature, despising the conventional pruderies of the world. She had not scorned my proposals. She had not sheltered herself in silence. She had not returned my letter unopened. She had even sent me, in reply, one penned by her own exquisite fingers. It ran thus.
Monsieur Simpson will pardonne me for not compose the beautiful tongue of this contrée so well as might. It is only the late that I am arrive and not yet have the opportunity for to l'étudier. With this apology for the manière, I will now say that, Ella, Monsieur Simpson have guessed, but de tout true. Need I say more? Ella, am I not ready speak de tout moche?
Eugénie Leland. This noble-spirited note I kissed a million times and committed, no doubt, on its account, a thousand other extravagances that have now escaped my memory. Still, Talbot would not return. Alas, could he have formed even the vaguest idea of the suffering his absence had occasioned his friend, would not his sympathizing nature have flown immediately to my relief? Still, however, he came not. I wrote. He replied he was detained by urgent business, but would shortly return. He begged me not to be impatient, to moderate my transports, to read soothing books, to drink nothing stronger than hock, and to bring the consolations of philosophy to my aid. The fool! If he could not come himself, why, in the name of everything rational, could he not have enclosed me a letter of presentation? I wrote him again, entreating him to forward one forthwith. My letter was returned by that footman with the following endorsement in pencil. The scoundrel had joined his master in the country. Left S yesterday for parts unknown. Did not say where or when be back. So thought best to return letter, knowing your handwriting, and as you was always more or less in a hurry. Yours sincerely, Stubbs. After this, it is needless to say that I devoted to the infernal deities both master and valet. But there was little use in anger, and no consolation at all in complaint. But I had yet a resource left in my constitutional audacity. Hitherto it had served me well, and I now resolved to make it avail me to the end. Besides, after the correspondence which had passed between us, what act of mere informality could I commit, within bounds, that ought to be regarded as indecorous by Madame Lalande? Since the affair of the letter, I had been in the habit of watching her house, and thus discovered that about twilight it was her custom to promenade, attended only by a Negro in livery, in a public square overlooked by her windows. Here, amid the luxuriant and shadowing groves, in the gray gloom of a sweet midsummer evening, I observed my opportunity and accosted her. The better to deceive the servant in attendance, I did this with the assured air of an old and familiar acquaintance. With a presence of mind truly Parisian, she took the cue at once, and to greet me, held out the most bewitchingly little of hands. The valet at once fell into the rear, and now, with hearts full to overflowing, we discoursed long and unreservedly of our love. As Madame Lalande spoke English even less fluently than she wrote it, our conversation was necessarily in French. In this sweet tongue, so adapted to passion, I gave loose to the impetuous enthusiasm of my nature, and with all the eloquence I could command, besought her to consent to an immediate marriage. At this impatience, she smiled. She urged the old story of decorum, that bugbear which deters so many from bliss until the opportunity for bliss has forever gone by. I had most imprudently made it known among my friends, she observed, that I desired her acquaintance, thus that I did not possess it. Thus, again, there was no possibility of concealing the date of our first knowledge of each other. And then she averted, with a blush, to the extreme recency of this date. To wed immediately would be improper, would be indecorous, would be outré. All of this she said with the charming air of naivete, which enraptured while it grieved and convinced me. She went even so far as to accuse me, laughingly, of rashness, of imprudence. She bade me remember that I really even knew not who she was. What were her prospects, her connections, her standing in society? She begged me, but with a sigh, to reconsider my proposal, and termed my love an infatuation, a will-o'-the-wisp, a fancy or fantasy of the moment, a baseless and unstable creation rather of the imagination than of the heart. These things she uttered as the shadows of the sweet twilight gathered darkly and more darkly around us, and then, with a gentle pressure of her fairy-like hand, overthrew in a single sweet instant all the argumentative fabric she had reared. I replied as best I could, as only a true lover can. I spoke at length and perseveringly of my devotion, of my passion, of her exceeding beauty, and of my own enthusiastic admiration. In conclusion, I dwelt, with a convincing energy, upon the perils that encompass the course of love, that course of true love that never did run smooth, and thus deduced the manifest danger of rendering that course unnecessarily long. This latter argument seemed finally to soften the rigor of her determination. She relented. But there was yet an obstacle, she said, which she felt assured I had not properly considered. This was a delicate point, for a woman to urge especially so. In mentioning it, she saw that she must make a sacrifice of her feelings. Still, for me, every sacrifice should be made. She alluded to the topic of age. Was I aware, was I fully aware, of the discrepancy between us? That the age of the husband should surpass by a few years, even by 15 or 20, the age of the wife, was regarded by the world as admissible, and indeed as even proper. But she had always entertained the belief that the years of the wife should never exceed in number those of the husband. A discrepancy of this unnatural kind gave rise, too frequently, alas, to a life of unhappiness. Now she was aware that my own age did not exceed 22. And I, on the contrary, perhaps, was not aware that the years of my Eugenie extended very considerably beyond that sum. About all this, there was a nobility of soul, a dignity of candor, which delighted, which enchanted me, which eternally riveted my chains. I could scarcely restrain the excessive transport which possessed me. "My sweetest Eugenie," I cried, "what is all this about which you are discoursing? Your years surpass in some measure my own, but what then? The customs of the world are so many conventional follies. To those who love as ourselves, in what respect differs a year from an hour? I am 22, you say. Granted. Indeed, you may as well call me at once 23. Now you yourself, my dearest Eugenie, you have numbered no more than, can have numbered no more than, no more than. Here I paused for an instant, in the expectation that Madame Lalande would interrupt me by supplying her true age. But a Frenchwoman is seldom direct, and has always, by way of answer to an embarrassing query, some little practical reply of her own. In the present instance, Eugenie, who for a few moments past had seemed to be searching for something in her bosom, at length let fall upon the grass a miniature, which I immediately picked up and presented to her. "Keep it," she said with one of her most ravishing smiles. "Keep it for my sake, for the sake of her whom it too flatteringly represents. Besides, upon the back of the trinket you may discover perhaps the very information you seem to desire. It is now, to be sure, growing rather dark, but you can examine it at your leisure in the morning. In the meantime, you shall be my escort home tonight. My friends are about holding a little musical levee. I can promise you, too, some good singing. We French are not nearly so punctilious as you Americans, and I shall have no difficulty in smuggling you in the character of an old acquaintance." With this, she took my arm, and I attended her home. The mansion was quite a fine one, and, I believe, furnished in good taste. Of this latter point, however, I am scarcely qualified to judge, for it was just dark as we arrived, and in American mansions of the better sort, lights seldom, during the heat of summer, make their appearance at this, the most pleasant period of the day. In about an hour after my arrival, to be sure, a single shaded solar lamp was lit in the principal drawing room, and this apartment, I could thus see, was arranged with usual good taste and even splendor. But two other rooms of the suite, and in which the company chiefly assembled, remained during the whole evening in a very agreeable shadow. This is a well-conceived custom, giving the party at least a choice of light or shade, and one which our friends over the water could not do better than immediately adopt. The evening thus spent was unquestionably the most delicious of my life. Madame Lalande had not overrated the musical abilities of her friends, and the singing I here heard I had never heard excelled in any private circle out of Vienna. The instrumental performers were many and of superior talents. The vocalists were chiefly ladies, and no individual sang less than well. At length, upon a peremptory call for Madame Lalande, she arose at once, without affectation or demur, from the chaise lounge upon which she had sat by my side, and accompanied by one or two gentlemen and her female friend of the opera, repaired to the piano in the main drawing room. I would have escorted her myself, but felt that, under the circumstances of my introduction to the house, I had better remain unobserved where I was. I was thus deprived of the pleasure of seeing, although not of hearing, her sing. The impression she produced upon the company seemed electrical, but the effect upon myself was something even more. I know not how adequately to describe it. It arose, in part, no doubt, from the sentiment of love with which I was imbued, but chiefly from my conviction of the extreme sensibility of the singer. It is beyond the reach of art to endow either air or recitative with more impassioned expression than was hers. Her utterance of the romance in Otello, the tone with which she gave the words "Sul mio sasso" in the Capuletti, is ringing in my memory yet. Her lower tones were absolutely miraculous. Her voice embraced three complete octaves, extending from the contralto D to the D upper soprano, and though sufficiently powerful to have filled the San Carlos, executed with the minutest precision every difficulty of vocal composition. Ascending and descending scales, cadences, or fioriture. In the finale of the Sonnambula, she brought about a most remarkable effect at the words, Ah, non giunge uman pensiero al contento, anio son piano. Here, in imitation of Malibran, she modified the original phrase of Bellini so as to let her voice descend to the tenor G when, by a rapid transition, she struck the G above the treble stave, springing over an interval of two octaves.